we'll continue our study today of Leviticus chapter 25. And among many principles present in this chapter are the ones that every believer needs to pay attention to: release and redemption. It is in the Torah that the basics and the details about release and redemption are explained. And towards the end of this lesson, we're going to indeed delve into some fine detail about both of those principles, and I suggest you resist the urge to just kind of mentally wander off. I doubt any believer would argue that redemption's everything for us. But the New Testament fully expects its readers to already understand the nuances of these God-ordained ordinances that were so central to Israelite society. We left off last time in Leviticus 25, verses 18 and 19, which taught us that the land, Canaan, which the Lord would turn over to his people would only be productive when they were in it. In 1906, the French, who held much territory in the Middle East, took a census. And the total population of the Holy Lands was fewer than 60,000 people. It consisted of Bedouin, desert wanderers, fishermen along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea and some of the shores of the Galilee, and scattered goat and sheep herders, along with a handful of farmers. And as the Jews started to repopulate the land in earnest after World War II, and then the migration turned into a torrent after World War II, the land started to produce again. And I tell you this because this is another of the sorely overlooked principles that we're going to find in the Bible, and one that is totally backed up, validated by the hindsight of history. The land God set aside for his people prospered only when those who legitimately hold the lease were present. When they were not in the land quickly reverted to what it was in its natural state, dead and unusable. Now, I don't want to venture off into allegory or metaphor, but compare this reality to the miraculous birth of Isaac, the promised son of Abraham, who would lead to the birth of the nation of Israel in the form of his son Jacob. Isaac came from a womb, Sarah's, that was dead and useless until Yehovah declared that it would become the source for a nation of people set apart for himself. In parallel to creating a people set apart for him, he designated a land to be set apart for him and therefore to be populated by his people. God would take the land of Canaan away from the wicked Canaanites and then turn it over to Israel. Now, when ruled by the Canaanites, it was a spiritually dead place, even though it seemed to be full of good pasture land and fertile fields. When God set it apart for himself, and once Israel entered the land of Canaan, God declared that from that moment forward, the land would give up its fruit only for his people. When they weren't there, it'd be dead, be a useless place. When they were there, it would be vital and productive. Sadly, we are now eyewitnesses to the working out of this principle on the negative side. Notice what has happened in Gaza, beginning with the day it was turned over to the Palestinians. What was a critical food-growing region for Israel is now a place that can't even support its own population. Before Israel won back the Gaza in 1967, it was desolate, almost a completely unpopulated area. Once Jewish settlers moved in, farming began and the desert bloomed. By the time the Jews gave the land to the Palestinians in August 15th, 2005, the Jewish farms of Gaza supplied fully one-third of all the produce raised in Israel. The place is well on its way now to becoming a wasteland again. I don't care what the UN tries to do. I don't care what the US tries to do with its aid or how science is capable of increasing productivity of the land. The Gaza began to revert to its natural state of death and uselessness on August the 15th, 2005. This isn't some wild prediction on my part. It's already happened. Because it's simply the way the land set aside for Israel operates because God declared it. It's a supernatural thing. And as such, it's not going to be defeated by men. Let's reread a portion of Leviticus 25 to get our bearings for today. We're going to read from verses 20 to 34. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, Ed is on, we begin on page 139. Leviticus 25, starting at verse 20. If you ask, if we aren't allowed to sow seed or harvest what our land produces, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? Then I will order my blessing on you during the sixth year, so that the land brings forth enough produce for all 3 years. The eighth year you will sow seed, but eat the old stored produce until the ninth year. That is, until the produce of the eighth year comes in, you'll eat the old stored food. The land is not to be sold in perpetuity because the land belongs to me. You're only foreigners, temporary residents with me. Therefore, when you sell your property, you must include the right of redemption. That is, if one of you becomes poor and sells some of his property, his next of kin can come and buy back what his relative sold. If the seller has no one to redeem it, he becomes rich enough to redeem it himself, he'll calculate the number of years that the land was sold for, refund the excess to its buyer, and return to his property. If he hasn't sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he sold will remain in the hands of the buyer until the year of Yovel, Jubilee. And in the Jubilee, the buyer will vacate it, and the seller will return to his property. And if someone sells a dwelling in a walled city, he has 1 year after the date of sale in which to redeem it. For a full year, he will have the right of redemption. But if he's not redeemed the dwelling in the walled city within the year, then title and perpetuity passes to the buyer throughout all his generations. It will not revert in the Jubilee. However, houses and villages not surrounded by walls are to be dealt with like the fields in the countryside. They'll be redeemed before the Jubilee, and they revert in the Jubilee. Concerning the cities of the Levites and the houses in the cities that they possess, the Levites are to have a permanent right of redemption. If someone purchases a house from one of the Levites, then the house he sold in the city where he owns property will still revert to him in the Jubilee, because the houses in the cities of the Levites are their tribe's possession among the people of Israel. The fields and the open land around their cities may not be sold, because that is their permanent possession. Okay, in verse 20, where the subject is the Sabbath year rest for the land, we get a most reasonable rhetorical question that any thinking Israelite would have asked when they were informed about this new ordinance of God. What are we going to eat in the seventh year if we can neither sow nor gather our crops? And God's answer is, I will ordain my blessing for you, but in the sixth year, so that it'll yield a crop sufficient for 3 years. Now, the word usually translated here as ordain is in Hebrew, tziva. And it carries with it a dual sense of something being commanded and something being sent. God is commanding nature to give up its bounty, and he's sending that bounty Israel's way. Nature has no choice in the matter, but Israel does. They can follow God's commandments about the Sabbath years and about the Jubilee, and then they can reap this 3-year bounty. Or they can ignore it and not receive it. But in a larger view, refusing to obey this law also means Israel's breaking the terms of the covenant. And the consequence for breaking the terms of the covenant is to incur God's curse. Now, in the following verses, we get some more specifics on land tenure and the redemption of property as it's to be practiced within Israelite society. And the thing we have to grasp is that the permanent selling of land is prohibited. In reality, the Hebrews can't sell the land even if they wanted to. Why? They don't own it. God does. Further, what this is alluding to is that a Hebrew who acquires land from another Hebrew is not buying the land. He's just taking over a land lease for a period of time that does not exceed 50 years. See, this prohibition against permanent land transfer is really aimed as much at the buyer as the seller. The seller is not ever to make a deal that purports to transfer the ownership of the land. And the buyer is not to ever think he's actually purchased the soil itself. The buyer, no matter how rich, no matter how powerful, is just a user of the land, not the owner. And even that status lasts just for a while, until the next year of Jubilee. Now in verse 23, where God instructs that the land is not to be sold beyond reclaim, your Bibles might say in perpetuity. Further, as we've discussed, the last half of that verse says why that is. The land is not yours, it's mine, says God. You guys, you Israelites, you're just folks hanging out with me here. Keep in mind that when the Bible, when the biblical laws use the word sell or sold as regards land in Israel, it's only a figure of speech. It is merely a common way of speaking. Instead, legally, from a Torah perspective, it's usually referring to transferring a leasehold. The meaning of not selling the land beyond reclaim is that one must allow for the land to be redeemed, to be reclaimed. This is a provision that both the buyer and the seller must adhere to. This is not optional. So when we read of any land transaction regarding land that's been set aside for Israel, the right of redemption is automatically included. It's a given. Now, don't confuse redemption with the Jubilee law. Redemption involves money. It involves also a third-party redeemer who pays the price for redeeming that land. The third-party redeemer is almost always a family member. And this redeemer family member is duty-bound to redeem the land. It's not an option for him. From the current the current holder of the land is also duty-bound to accept a proper redemption offer. In other words, if a proper and legal third-party redeemer approaches the current holder of the land with a proper and legal amount of money as the redemption price, that current owner can't refuse to allow redemption of the property. Just think about the Godfather. Here's an offer you can't refuse. Since it was not contemplated that an original landowner would sell the lease simply for business reasons, like owning rental real estate for profit, but rather something would essentially force that owner to transfer the land to another party, then verse 25 starts a series of examples of various situations by which land could be lost to its original holder. And the first situation involves a person falling on bad times. He's hit a low time. He's financially in a bad way. The result is he has to sell a piece of land. Now, this can either be that he needs the money for some unexpected and critical reason, or more usually, he can't pay a debt that he owes to somebody. And so that debt holder takes the land in payment. Therefore, a close relative, usually the closest relative, who has the ability and the means to come up with the required money, is obligated by the Torah to redeem that land in the name of the family member who lost it. And to be clear, the redeeming family does not get to keep the land. He doesn't even hold it until that poverty-stricken family member is somehow able to come up with the needed funds to pay him back. The redeemer pays the price. Listen to this. Principle in Leviticus. The redeemer pays the price, but the poor person gets the benefit of what he did. Verse 26 is the second example. Here the situation is that a person who lost his land has no one in his family that has the means to redeem the land for him. Either he has no close relatives, or none of his relatives can come up with the money. However, if after losing the land, that person now recovers financially, and he produces enough funds to meet the redemption price, proper redemption price, then the new owner must, by God's law, sell it back to him. Further, the method for determining the redemption price is that the new owner must subtract from the price that he paid a reasonable amount for the time he got use of that land. Example, a man owes a debt of $500, can't pay it. The holder of the debt forecloses on the man's land. A reasonable calculation shows that the crops that can be raised on the land are worth $100 each year. 3 years later, the man who lost his land is financially better off, and he has now a means to reclaim his land. Since the original debt was $500, and since the new owner got 3 years of crop benefit from holding the land, which amounts to $300 worth of benefits, then the redemption price is $200. $500 debt, $300 from the crops that were raised on the land, leaves $200 left to repay. Now, it wasn't always quite that simple, but that's basically the way it was intended to work. Next, the use of the Jubilee year provisions is injected. If the man who lost his land cannot ever come up with the money to redeem his land, or let's say he has no kinsman that can or will redeem the land for him, then he waits until the Jubilee year to get it back. In the Jubilee year, the new holder of the land must release it back to the man who lost it at absolutely no cost. The effect of the Jubilee return of property is a full and complete release. The effect of buying the property back at a price is the redemption. Release, redemption, they are related, but they're two different processes. In verse 29, we get a third example of how a piece of property can be transferred from the original owner. What if a man doesn't have a piece of land, but instead he owns a house inside of a walled city? Perhaps he's a merchant, a craftsman, he's not a farmer or herder. The law in this case is that he has only 1 year if he transfers ownership of his house to another, whether selling it for any reason or indebtedness or whatever. He only has a year to redeem it. And after 1 year, that new owner has no obligations to him. The house is lost forever. The arrival of the Jubilee does not return the house to the original owner. So we see a real stark difference between the treatment of a dwelling place only versus the land when it comes to release and to redemption. In verse 31, we see that houses that are not inside a walled city, but instead are located out in the outlying villages, they're to be treated as though they were land. That's the same rules apply to houses outside of city walls as it does to the land. And if someone loses a house that's located outside a city wall in a village, the period to redeem it then never expires. Further, the village house must be returned to the former owner in the year of Jubilee. The idea is that invariably, a person with a house in a village has a piece of land that goes with it. And usually, even if that person was a craftsman, some amount of his food was grown on that land. Now, that wasn't always the case, but it was more often than not. Recall now that when the Israelites finally entered the land of Canaan after leaving Egypt, which has not yet happened at this point in Leviticus, there was a land allotment that was made to each tribe. But there was one Israelite tribe that didn't get a territory all of its own, the tribe of Levi. And they were set apart from Israel to be God's special servant, his priests. The Levites instead then were to receive cities located in each and every one of the 12 tribal districts. Further, a small amount of land that was attached to each city was included in the deal. Now, some of the 48 cities the Levites lived in as theirs were apparently walled cities. And whereas all the other Israelites would permanently lose their homes within those walled cities if they weren't redeemed within a year, there wasn't any kind of limit like that placed on the homes of the Levites. Further, their walled city house had to be returned to them upon the year of Jubilee. Verse 34 gives us the provisions for something most homeowners are familiar with. Here it states that a Levite cannot ever lose his land, not even due to indebtedness. That is, whoever loans money to a Levite is taking the full risk upon himself because he can't foreclose on the Levite's land. Thus, we have the principle of homesteading. Homesteading generally protects a person from losing their home except for default on the home mortgage. A homesteaded house can't be taken from you to satisfy a judgment that arises from some other debt or even an act of negligence on your part or whatever. It cannot be taken from you due to bankruptcy, provided you either maintain your mortgage payments or you own your home outright. Now, Levites, as God's servants, could never lose their land inheritance. Let's read a little bit more of Leviticus 25. We're going to go from 35 to the end. If a member of your people has become poor so that he can't support himself among you, you are to assist him as you would a foreigner or a temporary resident so that he can continue living with you. Don't charge him interest or otherwise profit from him, but fear your God, so that your brother can continue living with you. Do not take interest when you loan him money or take a profit when you sell him food. I'm Adonai, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt in order to give you the land of Canaan and be your God. If a member of your people has become poor among you and he sells himself to you, do not make him do the work of a slave. Rather, you are to treat him like an employee or a tenant. He'll work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then he'll leave you, he and his children with him, and return to his own family and regain possession of his ancestral land. For they are my slaves, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, they'll not be sold as slaves. Do not treat him harshly, but fear your God. Now, concerning the men and women you have as slaves, you are to buy men and women slaves from the nations surrounding you. You may also buy the children of foreigners living with you and members of their families born in your land. You may own these. You may also bequeath them to your children to own, From these groups you may take your slaves forever, but as far as your brothers, the people of Israel, are concerned, you're not to treat each other harshly. If a foreigner living with you has grown rich, and a member of your people has become poor and sells himself to this foreigner living with you or to a member of this foreigner's family, he may be redeemed after he's been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or any near relative of his may redeem him, or if he becomes rich, he can redeem himself. He will calculate with the person who bought him the time from the year he sold himself to the year of Jubilee. And the amount to be paid off will be according to the number of years and his time at an employee's wage. If many years remain, according to them will he refund the amount of his redemption from the amount he was bought for. If there remains only a few years until the year of Jubilee, then he'll calculate with him. According to his years, will he refund the amount for his redemption? He will be like a hired worker year by year. You will see to it that he's not treated harshly. If he has not been redeemed by any of these procedures, nevertheless, he will go free in the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. For to me, the people of Israel are slaves. They're my slaves, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am Adonai, your God. Well, up to now, we've dealt more with the redemption and Jubilee year release of real property. This section changes course. Now it deals with human property, people, and people who have become bondservants or slaves. And it walks us through a couple of stages of financial difficulties that people found themselves in the Bible era that would lead to their becoming slaves or to bondservants. And starting in verse 35, the situation is that a person described as a kinsman has become poor, and he owes a debt to somebody. Moreover, this particular kinsman is somewhat like a resident alien, in the sense that because resident aliens cannot hold land, they are workers, then, who just work for wages. So what we have here is the case of a peasant Hebrew who simply works for wages. He is an employee. He has no land to work and grow food for himself. The word used for kinsman in this instance is in Hebrew, ach, which literally means brother. But ach is also a common word, kind of a generic word that means countryman. So the idea is that while this poor person might be a close relative, he could simply be an Israelite. And so all Israelites are his brothers. So the instruction here is that one Israelite is not to charge another Israelite interest on either money or provisions, at least when the borrower must borrow, because he's poor. He has no other choice to survive. Starting in verse 39, however, the financial situation of the poor person has declined even further. He's borrowed the money at no interest, but he's still not able to pay it back. The result is that this poor person now becomes an indentured servant. That is, he's assigned to the person who loaned him the money until such time that that debt is paid off by means of his labors. Usually that meant that the poor person and his family lived on the estate of the one who loaned him the money. The idea is that this indebted person does not become a slave. He's not been purchased. He's not property. He's more like an employee. But that employee is bound. He must work for the creditor and the creditor alone. However, the longest period of time that that person can remain indebted and remain bonded to his master as until the year of Jubilee, at which point this indentured servant has to be released and whatever remains of his debt has to be canceled. Further, the master can't let the male go, but then keep his wife and children. The whole family has to be released. Now, the principle behind this law is laid down in verse 42. It's a very simple one. All Israelites belong to God. He redeemed them. He purchased their freedom from slavery when he took them out of the land of Egypt. They're his slaves. And he's not selling them. They're not for sale. So another underlying principle is a redeemed person cannot be another slave. And every Israelite was redeemed. The effect of this law is that no Israelite can own a Hebrew slave. Now understand, a bondservant is not a slave. A bondservant is not the property of his master. He's more like an exclusive employee. That said, verses 44 to 46 make it clear that Hebrews can own human slaves. It can be their property. It's just that these slaves have to be foreigners, Gentiles, non-Israelites, people from other nations. So according to the law, a Hebrew can buy a foreigner as a slave, and if that foreigner has children, then those children are also his slaves. And not only that, but because slaves are indeed property, just like land or furniture, they can be handed down from one generation of a Hebrew family to the next one. No provision is made in the law for a foreign slave to be redeemed. They're stuck. No hope. Now let me emphasize that principle so that this is really clear. The only people who could be redeemed and thus freed of their debts were those who were under the covenant that God made with Israel. You clear on that? That's it. Foreigners who want to be no part of Israel were allowed to become part of Israel if they changed their minds. Now they would be under the provisions of the covenant. But foreigners who did not want to become part of Israel and never did become part of Israel, they were outside the provisions of the covenant that God made with Israel. That same principle applies to salvation. In fact, it is the basis of salvation. We are saved only under the provisions of the covenant that God made with Israel. There is no Gentile covenant with God. And part of that provision is, of course, a saving Redeemer, a saving Messiah. So in Romans 11, we have St. Paul's conclusion that foreigners who want to be saved have to be, and this is a standard Christian church term, what? Grafted in. They have to be grafted in. To what? To Israel's covenants. Because it's only within those covenants where there are provisions for God's salvation of human beings. Where else is there one? Doesn't exist. Verse 47 illustrates yet another situation. A well-to-do foreigner, non-Hebrew, living among Israel, loans money to a Hebrew. Hebrew can't pay it back. By law, that Hebrew becomes a bondservant to the foreigner. However, while a Hebrew can own a foreign slave, a foreigner living among Israel cannot own a Hebrew as a slave. Further, it falls to a family member of the Hebrew debtor to redeem him from his bondservant status to the foreigner. Or, alternately, if somehow this bondservant prospers, he's allowed to redeem himself. The remainder of this chapter shows how the redemption price for the bondservants to be calculated. We're not going to go over it because it basically works the same as if a piece of land was being redeemed. Now, let me state at this point that while the duty of a kinsman to redeem a person's land for him was a very important one, the duty of a kinsman to redeem his own family member from a servitude to a foreigner was an exceptionally high duty. God makes it clear that in principle, no Israelite ought to ever be a servant or a slave to anyone except God, and then by one's own free will. Why? God has redeemed them. They belong to Him. But for an Israelite to be a servant or a slave to a non-Israelite, well, that's viewed as an abomination. And it is the duty of his family to go to whatever personal sacrifice necessary to extract that poor Hebrew from his situation. Okay, now, let's take a little detour. As you've seen over the last three lessons, it's in Leviticus 25 that we find kind of embedded within the laws of Jubilee the concept and the duties of the kinsman redeemer. And his duties are detailed for us. And I suspect many of you immediately recollect that Jesus Christ, Yeshua, is often referred to as our kinsman redeemer. We've all heard sermons about this. Naturally, he's going to be the reason for my detour. Now, in Leviticus 25, we're told that the purpose of a kinsman redeemer is to rescue the land of a family member or of a person in the family from being lost to someone else. That is, somebody in the family, usually due to a debt, loses some or all of their land, or they wind up themselves in bond servitude. And the method of losing the land is that the land is sold, it's exchanged to satisfy an indebtedness. Or that person not having any land to sell becomes a bond servant to the lender, which pays off the debt. But the law was that if that situation happened, there was automatically a right of redemption of that land or that person. And in the case of land, either the person who originally owned the land could come up with enough money to pay the price to get it back, or a family member would come to pay off the debt. In the case of a person who became a bondservant, if somehow he could come up with the money himself, he could purchase his own freedom. Or more often, a family member paid the redemption price on his behalf. In fact, it was the duty of a family member to redeem that land on his behalf or to purchase that person's freedom if the relative had the money. So the general rule was that the closest family member was the first in line to accomplish the redemption. If he didn't have the means, then the duty went to the next family member. He didn't have the means, to the next closest, on and on and on. A key principle of this system was that the kinsman redeemer did not get to keep the land he redeemed for his family member, nor if that family member had become a bondservant, did that family member now legally become that kinsman redeemer's bondservant. That said, out of gratitude, a person could, and did often, offer to stay under the authority of the person who redeemed him. So the kinsman redeemer paid the price of the debt that was owed, but the family member who lost their land or their personal freedom got the benefit of. The kinsman redeemer did not realize any personal benefit from his act of kindness and duty, but he was legally required to do this as an act of self-sacrifice. Although we haven't discussed it yet, that was not the only aspect of being a kinsman redeemer. Another purpose of a kinsman redeemer was to act as one who avenged the wrongful death of a family member. That is, if somebody in your family was killed at the hands of another, whether it was accidental or a premeditated murder, a close family member was duty-bound to hunt them down and take their life. In fact, the primary purpose of those Levitical cities in Israel, designated as sanctuaries or refuges, was to provide a safe haven from a kinsman redeemer bent on revenge. And while we're not going to get into all the nuances of the cities of sanctuary or refuge, just let me state that a premeditated murder did not typically get protected by a sanctuary city. There was a board of elders in each city who determine whether to let a person who was fleeing in or not. And usually somebody who'd committed a criminal act that led to loss of life was not permitted in. It was more normal that it would be for an unintentional act, or perhaps two men were fighting in the heat of battle, one killed the other. So sanctuary wasn't so much about guilt or innocence, per se. It was about protecting someone from the customary vengeance of a kinsman redeemer. There's even another aspect of a kinsman redeemer we ought to know about. It was that a male family member was to marry a female family member who had lost her husband to death if she had not yet borne a son as an heir for her now deceased husband. The idea was that by a kinsman redeemer marrying her, she would eventually get pregnant, have a son, and the son would carry on in the name of her deceased husband. Therefore, her husband's name would continue, and then his line would not be ended. The first type of kinsman redeemer, the type who buys back land, is called in Hebrew a goel, a goel. The second type of kinsman redeemer, the type who avenges the death of a family member, is called a goel hadam, a blood avenger. The third type of kinsman redeemer, the type who marries the sonless widow, is also called a goel. Now, before we start connecting these dots, let's understand the meaning of the term kinsman. There are several Hebrew words that have been translated into English as kinsman, but they all denote something a little bit different. The most frequent Hebrew word translated as kinsman in our Bibles is ach, more meaning brother. But brother can mean a male sibling, or it can mean a close relative, and even sometimes it's used to indicate a brother-like relationship, someone who's perhaps not related by blood, but to whom you're very close. Usually when ach is used, it means a close relative. Another Hebrew word for kinsman is karov. And literally, karov means near. But in the context of a family, it means a near relative. Yet another common Hebrew word for kinsman is moda. Moda. And it usually means an intimate friend who's as close as a brother. Now, in the Bible, as I hope you understand by now, context is everything. So a kinsman can mean anything from a member of your immediate family, like your brother, to a member of your extended family, like a cousin, even so far as to a member of your tribe. In its broadest sense, it can also indicate any member of the nation of Israel, but it doesn't extend any further than that. From a physical and a national sense, no foreigner, no resident alien can be designated a kinsman of Israel. For instance, even if an Israelite had a very close friend who was, say, an Egyptian or a Canaanite, that friend would not be considered a kinsman, an ach, for any legal purpose. So in any of these cases involving redemption that I've told you about, generally, the term kinsman indicates a blood relationship. Now, some of you might say, but wait a minute now, a foreigner can become a full-fledged Israelite, and that is true. But once a foreigner becomes an Israelite, he's not a foreigner anymore. Once the foreigner gives his allegiance to Israel, Jacob is now his father too, for all legal purposes. So let's be very clear. Biblically speaking, a kinsman can only be within one own nation or people group. Therefore, when we get all these rules and ordinances about kinsmen and kinsmen redeemers in the Bible, it's about relationships among Israelites only. Foreigners are excluded. Now, I got a good one for you. How many times in the New Testament do we have Yeshua referred to as our kinsman redeemer? Any guesses? 2, 3, 9, 12? No ventures, huh? Try 0. What? That's right. Try 0. Oh, he is indeed our redemption and our Redeemer, but nowhere in the New Testament is he called our kinsman Redeemer. Does that make you squirm a little bit? Good. Because if you think, you still insist that the Bible starts at the book of Matthew for Christians, then the Old Testament is irrelevant, that Jesus nailed the cross, you got a problem. Because your New Testament never refers to him as your kinsman redeemer. So where does this idea, this doctrine, that Yeshua, our Messiah, is our kinsman redeemer, come from? From the Old Testament. There are 33 references to kinsman redeemer in the Old Testament, and half of them refer to the future Messiah or to God himself. Most of these references are in Isaiah. Of course, the definition and duty of a kinsman redeemer is fully set out in Leviticus chapter 25. We've been reading it. So if the law is dead and gone, why are most evangelical preachers, the most adamant the law has been replaced by grace folks, insist that the Levitical law of the kinsman redeemer now applies to Jesus? Didn't make any sense. How come we just love to turn our Bibles to the supposedly obsolete book of Ruth when we want to understand the purposes of a kinsman redeemer, and then we go off and apply it to our New Testament Messiah? Now, obviously, I'm being a tad sarcastic. Yes, of course, Yeshua is our kinsman redeemer, but we can only know that from Old Testament principles, not New Testament statements to that effect, because there aren't any. So let's just see how Yeshua is our kinsman redeemer based on the principles of the Torah, the law. Listen to Yeshua's own words. In Luke 4:18, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and to set free those who are downtrodden, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. Wonder what that is. Of course. It's what we've just been studying in Leviticus. He speaks of release, setting free those who are downtrodden, proclaiming the favorable year of the Lord. That's just an idiom for the Jubilee. Yeshua is speaking about the principles of Jubilee, and therefore the purposes of a kinsman redeemer, a goel. Not only that, as I told you, at least half of the New Testament, and actually it's a little more, is only Old Testament quotes. And the one in Luke that I just read to you is Jesus quoting from Isaiah. Listen to Isaiah 61:1. The Spirit of the Lord God's upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring the good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, freedom to the prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. How about that? You mean our New Testament Savior is running around quoting Old Testament verses? I'll tell you something. You want to know what the Bible looked like? That Yeshua and all his disciples and everybody for the next 100 years ran around with making new believers from? Then take your Bible and the page before the book of Matthew, take it with a razor blade and throw away your New Testament. What's left is the Bible they had. That was the Bible from which they went around and told people about the gospel. The Old Testament. There was no New Testament until shortly after 200 AD. Didn't exist. Now, this aspect of the kinsman redeemer, the one who brings release, the one who sets the downtrodden free, is the one that we Gentile Christians and Jewish messianics think most about. We were in bondage, we were slaves, to evil and sin. We have no out but to have a kinsman redeemer. More, we were foreigners. We were outside of Israel. We have no part in their covenants. Thus, as we've seen in Leviticus 25, verses 44 through 46, those foreigners, those who are outside of Israel, they could be slaves to anybody in perpetuity. Their descendants could be, with no hope for them for redemption. Let me say it again, because this principle is as central to salvation as is the need for blood to atone for sins. Foreigners, those who outside of a connection with Israel, have no provision of redemption available to them. And next we learned that the kinsman redeemer must have the means to redeem. He can't just wanna, he's got to be able to. He must be able to pay that full redemption price with no discount coupon. A good enough person might want to redeem. He may want to provide the redemption price to free his brother, but often he couldn't because he just didn't have the wherewithal to do it. Debt holders didn't accept IOUs from kinsmen redeemers. They wanted the price paid in full right now. Well, I got news for you. God doesn't accept IOUs either. The problem for mankind is that the debt we owe to God due to our sin is our death, eternal death. That's what's owed. Either we pay our debt for that death, or the kinsman redeemer had to pay the price. The kinsman redeemer follows the pattern of substitution. The pattern of substitution is exhibited in animal sacrifice that forms the whole basis for the Levitical sacrificial system. But it had to be a perfect sacrifice. It had to be innocent. It had to be an innocent animal. It had no sin in it. Mankind had waited 4,000 years for a kinsman redeemer, a third party who would qualify to be a kinsman and to have the means to pay that price. No animal can be a kinsman to a human. You see that? There's no animal. I don't care how much you love your dog. Your dog can't redeem you. Your dog can't pay your debts for you, can he? There was no provision in the law for an animal to pay your debts, to animal to be your kinsman redeemer. Had to be a human, of course. So while an animal could make its blood could stave off God's wrath temporarily by making atonement, an animal could never be your kinsman. And yet, what human is 100% sin-free in both nature and behavior? Yeshua, Jesus Christ, was the one and only Redeemer who had all the qualifications, who had the means and the will to be our kinsman Redeemer. We'll explore that a little bit more next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.